Very good. All right. So, like John yesterday said that he was trying to interdisperse theory talks and experimental talks. Well, this talk is going to be interspersed theory and experiment together. This work is done in pretty close collaboration with my longtime collaborator and good friend Paul Yeston at the University of Arizona, and it was the joint thesis project of our respective students, Andrew Silberfarb and Greg Smith. I think it's fairly obvious to everyone here that one of the fundamental problems in quantum mechanics is to somehow assign a quantum state to a system. And in the context of decoherence, the subject of this meeting, of course, in order to, in some sense, see the decoherence, it would be nice and really understand its mechanisms. We want to more than just see some decay of some particular observable. We might want to know in detail what aspects of decoherence are affecting our knowledge about the system. And our knowledge about the system is encoded in the quantum state. So that's the problem, and it's called quantum state estimation or quantum tomography in some contexts. And let's just think about it a little bit from an information theoretic perspective. I'm going to be restricting my attention here to thinking about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And if I have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, then if I do a measurement on one system that lives in this Hilbert space, at most I can get log d bits of information. So if I measure a spin 1/2 particle, I'm going to find out, is it spin up or is it spin down? I find out a bit of information. Of course, if I want to measure a density matrix, of unit trace that I know is normalized state, has d squared minus 1 real parameters. If I want to measure each of those parameters, each of those real numbers, to some precision with some b bits of information, then the total number of bits of information I need is b times d squared minus 1. So, of course, I can't do that with one system. Everyone knows that if I want to measure, in some sense, or estimate a quantum state, or assign a quantum state, depending on your perspective, I need many copies of the system, typically prepared in the same state. I guess I'll point with this guy. Okay. So the way in which we think about this, our basic requirements for doing quantum state reconstruction is I want to do measurements on these many copies, and I need what's called an informationally complete set of measurements. I need some measurements I'm going to do with certain, each measurement M super I has J max different outcomes, and they occur with some probabilities. And this set of probabilities should then be in one-to-one correspondence with the density matrix. And that allows me to assign a density matrix based on these probabilities. Okay. So the standard approach that we're mostly familiar with in doing this process involves doing projective or strong measurements of usually Hermitian observables, but not necessarily. Could do a PLVM, more generally. In any event, I do typically do strong measurements on a whole set of these, get these outcomes at certain frequencies, do it many, many times, and then from the number of times assign a probability based on the frequency of outcome. And if I have many, many copies, in principle I could do this with an accuracy or the total number of bits available. If I have capital N copies, I have N log to base 2 of the dimension bits of information available to me in order to reconstruct the density matrix. So a trivial example of this, just to set the stage, is if I wanted to measure, say, the density matrix associated with a spin 1/2 particle, I can imagine doing this set of information complete set of measurements, measure the the value of spin projected along z, x, and y, and from those I can extract the values of the diagonal and off-diagonal matrix elements of the density matrix relative to this quantization axis z. Okay, so that's a standard procedure. Just a quick note here, instead of rotating my apparatus, I could rotate the spin, obviously, and do the same measurement. I could think about that as going to the Heisenberg picture and evolving the observable. Okay. So what I want to say here is that there are some challenges for this approach. In order to do this, I mean, what we would really like is this to be some kind of useful diagnostic tool in the laboratory for evaluating whether or not your apparatus is performing and doing the, say, quantum information processing tasks that you would like. And so you want this to be as robust, fast, least cumbersome procedure possible. And as we described it, you know, if I want to do this, I need an informationally complete set of measurements. I need at least d plus 1 different observables that I'm going to then re-prepare the system over and over again in order to get the statistics I need. At the end of the day, if I do it in this way, my system is, the state is destroyed because I've done strong projective measurements. And in a sense, I've wasted a lot of information in the process that I didn't have to. We heard yesterday Ash was talking about the question of quantum back action due to the fact that you gained information. But at the beginning I said, you know, I wanted to measure my density matrix with some precision b, a bit for information. But, you know, I might have a million atoms here, and I needed a lot in order to get good signal-to-noise ratio anyway. So really, there was more back action than necessary by doing the Stern-Gerlach at the very beginning and throwing away the whole ensemble. I didn't need to do that. I didn't really need to erase the entire state of every member of the ensemble. I'd have to erase the state of some members of the ensemble consistent with the number of bits of information that I extracted, but I didn't have to erase every single one of them. So the alternative that I'm going to present here and show you an experimental demonstration of it is how one can, in principle, reconstruct the quantum state based on a weak continuous measurement that in some sense doesn't destroy the quantum state, or does it on such a few members of the ensemble that you wouldn't even know the difference. It's buried in the noise anyway. Okay, so here's just sort of an abstraction, and I will be talking about this in the context of atomic spins interacting with a meter that is the off-resonant laser beam who has a certain polarization state, and you know, we'll measure some photocurrent to get some continuous measurement signal. I'll explain this in some detail. But abstractly, what I have is some measurement signal as a function of time, which I can think about is the time evolving average value of some observable of one member of these ensemble. So I'm going to make the assumption that I'm coupling to all members of the ensemble equally. I started in this product state, and so I have n times the expectation value of one of the observables, and then I'm going to have noise on the system, okay? So I'm not going to necessarily get the expectation value, and that noise is coming mostly, in this case, from the fact that my meter is a quantum object, and so there is shot noise on the measurement, okay? So that's what this noise is. It depends to some degree. Now, I could average that noise for a long time, and in principle, eventually what I'm going to see are fluctuations due to the fact that my quantum state was not at an eigenstate necessarily of the observable that I'm measuring, and that's what's called projection noise. But I'm going to make the assumption that my shot noise is big compared to my projection noise. So at the moment, that's the weak measurement assumption. It means that this is an optically thin sample on resonance. And that assumption that all the noise is due to shot noise and there's no, say, shot-to-shot fluctuations due to projection noise is fine, because what I'm interested in here is not measuring, at this point, the many-body state and the, all of the interesting physics about what the different many-body eigenstates are is, in some sense, in the projection noise. Here, I'm just interested in what a single member of the ensemble is doing, okay? So, in principle, you know, this can be applied to many systems, as in NMR or doing weak measurements in electron transport, etc. But the main point here is that in principle, this could be done in a fast and efficient manner and one shot. I don't need to re-prepare the ensemble each time in exactly the same state, measure some different observable, throw it away, and do tomography. In principle, we're going to find a way to have one ensemble and measure in a way through some time history the entire set of informationally complete set of operators. And then in principle, if I could do this really fast, well, we're really not there yet, but we hope to get there, then in principle I might be able to do some kind of quantum state feedback in which I control the system conditional on not just the mean value of some parameter, classical parameter, but on some more complicated moments of the distribution. Okay, so the basic theoretical protocol for doing this was described in a paper last year. It's really the brainchild of Andrew Silberfarb. He deserves the lion's share of the credit here. So what we're going to imagine doing is we're going to continuously measure some observable O. Okay, and what we're going to do is apply a time-dependent control to the system which continuously maps new information onto that observable. Or you can think about in the Heisenberg picture, that observable is evolving in time, and you're measuring a different observable. And then, based on the information we get up to that time, we're going to have some kind of Bayesian analysis that allows us to update our state of knowledge, our state assignment, based on the data that we receive up to that point. And we want to somehow optimize this. Okay, so more formally, so as I said, we're going to work in the Heisenberg picture. So my observable is evolving as a function of time. And I'm more sloppy than Daniel. I don't have my double brackets there for my inner product, but that's exactly the same inner product that Daniel mentioned in his talk this morning. We're going to coarse grain now our measurement history to a discrete time series over some small slices, delta T, say, that represent the detector averaging time. And so our measurement history now becomes a stochastic time series related to some with the random Gaussian noise here related to the shot noise arising from the probe. Okay? So in order to, what we want to do is have this set O sub I, which we drive through the time-dependent controls that we are applying to the system, we want that to evolve through an informationally complete set of observables. So what that means is that we need a controllable system. We need to be able to generate the complete set of unitaries on our d-dimensional system, SUD. Okay? And the process is going to allow for that when the probe interacts with the system, it may not do so in a purely Hamiltonian way. It might also involve decoherence. So this is not the usual Heisenberg picture, because it's going to have a Liouvillean in it buried. Okay, so we've reduced the problem formally to a what's called a stochastic linear estimation problem. We want to, given the set of a measurement results, this measurement series, we want to invert it we can't do it perfectly because there's this uncertainty due to the noise, but get the best fit, a least squared fit, essentially, to the initial state. Okay? So we're going to do this using a Bayesian analysis. So the problem is we want to derive first a probability distribution that the state, the initial state was rho naught given the measurement history. Well, by Bayes' rule, that's proportional to the probability of getting a certain measurement history given that the state was rho naught times the prior probability distribution of rho naught. And this prior probability distribution contains the fact that this is a physical state with positive eigenvalues. Okay? Pretty much it, that's what rho is. Rho is a unit, I mean, also that's got unit trace. That's what rho is. We could, if we like, if we knew, we could, say, restrict our attention to pure states, initial pure states, if we knew that, or we were confident that we were being, and that would actually make the procedure would work a lot more quickly if we knew that it was pure, because that's a more highly constrained set of matrices than the general set of density operators. For the moment, we're not going to do that. We're just going to assume it's an arbitrary density operator. Yes? No, you have one. So I'll show you in more detail some realization of this. But the idea is that we have a system, and we're going to, you know, apply some Hamiltonian with some external fields to it. There's a probe on it, and then we measure one observable. Okay, and we get a measurement history. That measurement history will depend upon rho naught given a certain, we're going to apply the same time dependence all the time. Okay, and then different initial states should give different measurement histories. And what's going to be important is those different measurement histories have to be distinguishable enough in a short enough time for us to invert to deduce what the initial state was. But it's one copy. It's one set. I mean, there's many, many copies within this ball here. You know, many, many atoms. A million of them. Each of which ostensibly was prepared in the same state and is being coupled to the probe ostensibly equally. Of course, it's not exactly true. No, these are conditionals, conditional probabilities, and A is the normalization that has the information that you're describing. So this is... this is, at this time, there is some normalization constant, but it's irrelevant. We can renormalize at every stage, which is what we do. So that's this conditional probability that Ephraim mentioned. Let's say I get one particular measurement outcome, m sub I. I can ask what's the probability of getting that particular measurement outcome given that the initial state was rho naught. Well, since I have many, many copies of that, the central limit theorem tells me that basically I have a Gaussian distribution of possible probabilist outcomes centered at the expectation value with some variation due to the noise. Okay? Again, it's all shot noise here. So if I have a whole measurement history and they're all statistically independent, then the total probability distribution, conditional probability distribution, is some multidimensional Gaussian, which I can express in terms of a covariance matrix, R, which depends on the different observables that I'm observing, the expectation value of that super operator is just the product of all these Gaussian terms, okay? And so in the end, my estimate, up to some, you know, final point in this measurement history, is the least squared fit to the results. Yeah, I'm saying, sure, this, I'm not saying this, there's certainly that, you know, it's basically the question is that when I'm, because there's no back action on the system, for all intents and purposes, the probability distribution doesn't change given the measurement that I just made. If there is back action, it doesn't hold. Right. Again, it's because I have many, many, many copies, and the fluctuations due to the projection noise are tiny compared to the shot noise at this stage. Okay, so thought of in this kind of graphic picture, I can think about, okay, here's the space, you know, of all possible density matrices, and here's the green dot is the actual initial state I prepared. I do this first measurement along, you know, some abstract direction in density matrix space, and it you know, here's the mean value I get, but there's some spread due to the noise. So I've kind of narrowed it down into this little blue slice, and then I do another measurement along another one, and that narrows it down along some combinations. And the goal here is to keep shrinking down more and more and more and more, so that my estimate is, you know, pretty close. The most the maximum likelihood, and I've had too much coffee, this red dot is just jumping everywhere, is, you know, pretty close to the green dot. Okay, formally, I want to optimize the information gain as measured by the entropy of the Gaussian that describes the covariance matrix. So the covariance matrix, up to a certain stage, sort of measures how narrow this distribution is. And I want to make that, I want to do measurements. I haven't yet told you how I'm going to choose what measurements to do. That's all through that, you know, little arrow that goes through the ball that says H of T. I need to somehow steer the system to measure M2 now. And I want to do that independent of what the initial state is. Right, I want to do the same. I want to apply these controls. I don't know what the initial state is yet. The whole point here is to estimate it. Right, so I want to do something that's going to get me the most information about all the observables I need in order to deduce an arbitrary state. And by maximizing the signal to noise, which is related to the variance, you know, the covariance matrix, then I can do that. Okay, so maybe this will, for some people, help to put this in a concrete setting. The particular setting that we're going to be considering is the setting of measuring the spin of an atom with a large angular momentum. Large means 3, 7 sublevels. And we're going to do that using polarization spectroscopy. So the idea here is, you know, here's the ball. It's the ball of the atoms made in the magneto-optic trap. You send a beam through here. We're going to allow ourselves to control the atoms with external magnetic fields. Okay, so the magnetic these coils here control the magnetic field in the plane transverse to the direction of propagation, and then the atoms interact with the light, the atoms interact with the magnetic field, and then some information is written onto the light, and then we measure the relative intensities in some kind of polarization beam splitter. Okay? So I have our atomic spins. We're going to use this notation. We're talking about atoms with both nuclear and electronic spins. So we have F as our total angular momentum. Those spins Larmor process in a external magnetic field, and in addition, that spin manifold is affected by the light through the AC Stark shift. Okay, so the light will provide energy level shifts on the manifold of 2F plus 1, in this case 7 sublevels. And the measurements that we make are measurements on the light, and we can choose to measure either the difference between horizontal and vertical polarization, diagonal and anti-diagonal linear polarization, or right and left circular polarization. And these we recognize as the quantum analogs of the Stokes vector, or if you like, it's the Bloch vector of the photon on its Poincaré sphere instead of its Bloch sphere. Okay? So that's the measurement we're going to do, and this, the time-dependent thing that I mentioned here is all going to be applied by changing the time-dependent magnetic field, and in particular, just the X and Y components, Z being the propagation direction. So this magnetic field is going to rotate around back and forth in the XY plane in some chosen way. No, actually, we're not, although I put the hats on there for a reason that we will quantize it at the very end of the talk. But now, no. Okay, now I don't know how much I really want to spend time on this part, but let me just, for those who care, so we're looking at atoms that have, you know, some number of magnetic sublevels. We're looking at light off resonance, and the AC Stark shift, which is just the amount of energy that a polarizable particle sees in an external magnetic field, has a tensor property to it. The atoms react differently to different polarizations of light. And if we want to, if we re-express this expression, this contraction, in terms of irreducible tensor components, it's a useful exercise to do that. This AC Stark shift breaks up into an irreducible rank 1, rank 2, rank 0, rank 1, rank 2 part. One part that's independent of the internal state of the atom, a part that's like a vector-like part, and a part that's like an irreducible rank 2 part. And it's important for us to understand their physical effects. The scalar part is a state-independent shift and a scalar index of refraction. The rank 1 part looks like a Zeeman effect. It looks like a part that's just proportional to the angular momentum F, so it's like a rotation. It's a generator of SU2, okay? And physically, that gives rise it's a Zeeman-like shift on the atoms. It gives rise to the Faraday rotation of the light. This part, this irreducible rank 2 part, is a part that is nonlinear in the components of the angular momentum. So it does things beyond SU2 rotations. It has a nonlinear dependence on the spins. And physically, it gives rise to birefringence. It will change linear polarized light into elliptically polarized light in the output. Okay. Now, I should mention, for the atoms we're using, in this case alkali atoms, like this picture was kind of showing, you know, the atoms are in a ground state. They're L equals zero, so they would be isotropic. The index of refraction would be independent of internal state if it were not for spin, okay? Spin orbit leads to the vector term. Hyperfine interaction leads to higher moment terms. So in order to see this effect, I can't be too far detuned compared to hyperfine interaction, okay? But that's bad, because if I'm too close to the hyperfine interaction, in the ground, in the excited state, if I start to see the hyperfine splitting, then I'm going to get some photon scattering. And photon scattering is decoherence. So there's where our optimization comes. I really need to leverage off this nonlinear dynamics in order to explore the informationally complete set of measurements. But it comes at a price, and that price is decoherence. So the goal in the optimization is to sort of move through parameter space in the most efficient way possible, extract that information before decoherence kills you. So just to give you a picture of what these nonlinear dynamics things do, here's an older experiment where one just looks at putting a constant magnetic field, the atoms with Larmor precess, in the plane of the board. We would expect to see that Larmor precession as an oscillation in the relative intensities. And that's these big oscillations are the Larmor oscillation. You see two effects. This is the experiment. This is the simulation. One is, actually, the Larmor oscillations collapse and then revive. And that's due to the nonlinear term, that nonlinear term coming from that that quadratic term in the AC Stark shift. But in addition, there's a decay, and that's due to photon scattering. Okay. In this experiment, the detuning was off of the so-called D2 line, where the hyperfine splitting is small. If you go to the D1 line, where the hyperfine splitting is larger, you can get much more nonlinearity and see many more collapses and revivals within that decay time. And we want as much of that nonlinearity as possible that we can get our hands on. So we're going to probe near the D1 line. Moreover, we can simulate what you see is the collapses and revivals start to get a little bit smushed out in the experiment as well as in the theory, and that's because of inhomogeneities. The atoms are sitting in different parts of the laser beam, see different intensities, different nonlinearities, and we need to be able to simulate that if we're going to be able to invert the measurement history to get the initial state. Okay, so for the aficionados, those are the parameters. And so let me just, if anybody wants to see them again, we can show them. Just to give you a little bit of a sense, so I said in this picture, I showed you the decay and revival of the Larmor precession. What I'm going to show you here is just a quick simulation just of the dynamics with no decoherence, just to give you a sense of what happens to the state in the context of this combination of Larmor precession and nonlinearity. So what's being shown on this is just the mean value of Fz. Here's the density matrix. And right where this collapses, what you see now is right in between, there's what we call a cat state. A cat state, so let me try to go back for a moment here and just show you, that doesn't work so well, does it? Not on this screen. Oh, well. But quickly, if you look right in between, there'll be a superposition of 3 and minus 3 with maximum off-diagonal elements right in the collapse zone. So if we stopped it right in the middle there, we would have a cat state. Okay? There's another way to visualize that I think that's somewhat useful is to think about what a representation of the density matrix is in spherical harmonic distributions, the so-called spin-Wigner function. Okay, so a state which is has maximum projection along some direction is a little blob in that direction, and states that are superpositions will have fringes as superpositions of those. So here I'm going to show you that same evolution, but going into the rotating frame, rotating at the Larmor frequency. And what you see here is that, you know, right at this halfway point, sort of right about here, I have a superposition of spin up, or spin maximum projection 3, spin maximum projection minus 3, and in between. And eventually that, in the absence of any decoherence, it will recohere to being the spin projection maximum down. Okay. So that was just meant to show you that in principle we have controllability of our spin system. I think we heard some of you who were here for the meeting earlier from my student Seth Merkel, who told you about the optimal control problem. This is just to show you that in principle, with just the combination of the constant AC Stark shift coming from the probe together with the magnetic field, we can generate the full algebra that we need to get anywhere in this space. Okay, so given that, what we do is we try to drive the system with a magnetic field that's moving in this plane together with the AC star shift, and we want to find the angle that the magnetic field should be at as a function of time, and that's what I'm plotting for you here, in order to maximize the information gain as measured by the covariance matrix that describes how much I'm localizing in density matrix space. Okay? And so what we do is we pick 50 points and we do a local gradient search and then a global search on top of that and find, it's not the optimal, but it seems pretty good, waveform. So this, you know, was given to Greg Smith and say, drive your coils so that we get a magnetic field that does this. We do, I mean, there are, all of this is done within the constraints of the bandpass filters. That's to say, the slew rate as well as the bandwidth is consistent, to my knowledge, with what is in the lab. We don't try to make it any better, faster, or slower. We just say, let's assume that the detectors can move this quickly and that they have this much bandwidth, given that. Not no further cost than just choosing our slew rate and bandwidth consistent with what they can do. No, but we don't allow, they can only vary between certain things. Yeah. The problem is just that the problem is that the landscape is very, very, very jagged. So when Andrew first started to do this and tried to do something like that, he kept falling in very tiny local minimum. It's just we did so instead of doing a more sophisticated simulated annealing or something that would allow us to try to find a more global optimum along the lines that you're suggesting, what we did instead is we said, well, let's just look for points within the allowed bandwidth and slew rate and see where we get and how good we get, and they were good enough. Okay? Now, you know, the whole procedure is predicated on the idea that you can simulate the measurement history so well that you know exactly what you're seeing in the lab must have been, this is the initial state you produce, which means you have to know the calibration exactly. You have to know this is the magnetic field you're putting in, not it's proportional to something. This is the magnetic field. So one of the things that's a kind of a dirty little secret inside the experiment is that for some bizarre reason, the calibration is fluctuating as a function of time. That is to say, the voltage that you put on to these coils doesn't give you the same current every time. So we have to estimate the parameters of the experiment at the same time that we're estimating the state. But we do that. Okay, so here is an example, believe it or not, of theory and experiment together. And I'll show you this in more detail. So what I'm showing you here are three different prepared input states. And then at the end of the procedure, at the end of 1.5 milliseconds, what this reconstruction procedure gives as the estimated state and what its fidelity is. It's all single shot. These are tests. Okay, so this is done through optical pumping. Okay. And then Stern-Gerlach to double check. This is produced by the procedure that I just showed you. First you make this state, then you apply a constant magnetic field with AC Stark shift and stop at the point right in the middle where it's a cat state. And this state is right out of a Mott with no optical pumping. Okay? So under the assumption that these are the inputs, we don't really know that, obviously, that we're trying to estimate. But we have other counts. So I just want to firstly show you. So what's shown here is the actual measurement signal in red, and in blue is the simulated. So I'd say two things about this. One is this procedure works well because of two reasons. One, we can obviously simulate this experiment extremely well. Two, the different states give sufficiently distinguishable measurement histories that we have enough space between them to distinguish between these different states. So just to give you a picture of what happens, here is one example. So on the left here, I'm going to show you what we think is we prepared as the initial state. On the right here, I'm going to show you, as a function of time, how our reconstruction varies as a function of time. And up here, I'm going to show you what we, the continuous measurement signal that is measured in the data as a function of time on top of the theory. And what you see is it fluctuates, boom. It seems to lock on at about 300 microseconds or so. Okay? And so, you know, here's the fidelity as a function of time for those three different states that I showed you. The reason for this jump right here has to do with our prior information. The states that are pure states, it's a real constraint on them that they be positive density matrices. Okay, the ball of states around them that are different won't be real density matrix. The mixed state is right in the middle, so its fidelity, although it jumps at this point, still rises for a long time. Okay, so it's an artifact of our prior information, but it means we can do the state estimation very quickly. I guess I'm running out of time here, but I did want to say, I'm going to skip this. This is just pictures of sort of looking at spin squeezing in real time. And just mention a few words, just speculative, because I think it's interesting in the context of decoherence and the subject of this talk. So what I talked about there was controlling the individual spins and measuring their values. But what I think would be quite interesting direction for this to move is, can we control and learn things about the collective spin state? Okay? And so, for example, if I look at the collective spin, then if I look at, say, some nonlinear component of the collective spin, well, that's going to involve things like correlations between atoms. Okay, and it would be very nice. I mean, certainly people have thought about this in the context of spin squeezing of the collective spin. It would be a wonderful way to explore mesoscopic nonlinear dynamics, the quantum classical transitions, quantum phase transitions. So this is a platform in which we're hoping to think about those things. And here's just one quick example of this. This is a proposal in a paper that came out last year from the Japanese group, where what they do, and this is where quantizing the field is important, Brian. So let's just look at the system. I send through my probe in a Faraday rotation kind of geometry. The linear polarization will rotate by amount proportional to the magnetization of the atoms. I then send that back through a wave plate such that it turns that component into circular. That circular component then will drive the atoms and make them rotate proportional to the amount of circular polarization. And so that's effectively a nonlinear effect. The problem with this proposal, of course they realized it, is that the light carries away some information about the atoms, and that leads to decoherence. So on the Poincaré sphere, the polarization of the light started over here, but then rotated and came over here. So the light stores information about what the atom states was, and that will decohere the system and won't allow you to get the full nonlinear dynamics that you like. What we're hoping to do or thinking about is the question, can I do a kind of quantum eraser with feedback in which I measure the system in such a way that I erase the complementary information, which stored information about the atoms. Of course, I have to use that information. Just measuring the environment doesn't magically make the other thing recohere. That's a common misconception about the quantum eraser. I need to, conditioned on the measurement results, rotate the system in some particular way. But I think this is a promising sort of geometry to think about that. So I've gone over my time tremendously. I'll skip all this and just leave my summary. Thanks.